Well, thank you all for being on time. I will attempt to start on time on a regular basis. I know it's lunch break and it can sometimes be difficult to get moving or indeed to stay awake after lunch, but I'll do my best to help out on that front. This is Informatics 1, Cognitive Science. If that's not what you were expecting, now is your chance to beat a slightly embarrassed retreat. Nobody moves, that's good. My name is Henry Thompson. I'm the course lecturer. You'll see a lot of two people who are helping me with this. One is Mark McConville at the back there, and the other is Alyssa Alcorn. She'll be here on Friday. She's still she's at a conference this week. I'm not going to talk about administrative details and texts and assessments and all of that stuff today. We'll do that on Thursday in the next lecture. Today, I want to get started on what we're going to be doing here over the next 10 weeks or 11 weeks or so, and to dive right in to let you know what it is that we're aiming for, that we're going to be doing. So in the unlikely event that you're not sure what you want to do this term in terms of your outside subject, for those of you who are coming from outside informatics, or for your extra topic, for those of you who are doing one of the informatics degrees, if you're still making up your mind, I hope today will help give you a sense of what we're going to be chasing in the course of this term. And in some sense, most of what I'm going to do for the rest of the 50 minutes is to try to answer the question at a sort of introductory level anyway, of just what is cognitive science anyway. It is what we claim to be studying here. What is it? Well, it is about the mind, and it's about the brain, and it's about computers, and how they fit together. And for reference, that's too small. I need to make the illustrations a little bigger next week, or next lecture. And the way in which these things fit together, well, I've been a little too schematic and a little too simplistic, but roughly speaking, if what you're interested in is the relationship of neurophysiology, of neuroscience and computation, if you're a computer-literate, computer-based investigator of the neural mechanisms of the brain, then what you do is called computational neuroscience. And we have some astonishing folk here in informatics and in biology who work in that area, and I hope one of them will give us a guest lecture about halfway through the term. From another perspective, if what you're really interested in is the question of what is the relationship of the mind to the brain? What are these two things? How do we differentiate between them? What do we mean by mind anyway? Anytime you hear a sentence of the form, what do we mean by X anyway? That's a clue that the philosophers are about to come galloping over the hill and say, wait, that's my business. So philosophy of mind, again, I hope we'll have a visitor about halfway through who will tell us something about what they do from that perspective. But that's not quite what we're doing either. What we're doing is taking this new physical object, very, very new, only 60-odd years old, depending on how you count, the digital computer, and not so much even the physical object, but the idea of computation, and applying that to the questions which have traditionally been studied in the general area of the study of mind. And so we're looking primarily at that upper right-hand corner, although, as I said, we'll dabble in other parts of this space. I'm sorry to say, it's not about robots, at least not very much. I'm sorry for those of you who are fans of robots. And there's actually something quite important about this particular robot, which we will have a little bit to say about towards the end of the term. But that's not where our focus will be. Well, where is our focus going to be? All of psychology, linguistics, philosophy, neuroscience, and informatics. Well, that's a bit much. But a bit of each of those. And in particular, the question of how this notion of computation has changed the way we can do these studies, how the, what in German are called the Geisteswissenschaft, the knowledge sciences, the study of the mental and how it creates our world, that collection of studies has been transformed by the idea of computation, as well as by the literal physical artifacts of computation. And in order to do this, what we're going to do is focus on some particular examples, some examples which illustrate a bunch of the different ways in which this transformation has happened, in which things are not the way they used to be in psychology, in linguistics, and so on. And we're going to take two themes, two sources for our examples, if you will. One is going to be language, and the other is going to be a sort of composite, tightly coupled, of vision, memory, and attention. And in each of these, we're going to work through an illustration of a particular problem or triple of problems that are related to one another that illustrate what it means to do cognitive science. We'll read some key research papers. Along the way, we'll learn a little bit about what it means to read research papers. We'll do some very simple experiments. Not going to require any laboratories or any fancy equipment, but we'll do some experiments and we'll use ourselves as the subjects for those experiments. Because fundamentally, that intellectual tool that computing gives us has provided us with a methodology for studying the mind and its manifestations. By building models, and not just pencil and paper models, not just block diagrams of the sort that, say, cognitive psychologists have been drawing on pieces of paper for at least the last 70 or 80 years, but models which actually behave, that we can implement in a computer and run, and instrument and take apart and screw around with and break and compare the behavior of those artificial systems with the behavior of the real system, the one that's somewhere up in here and somewhere out in this room. And there's some interesting sort of side notes in there, because there's some things we can do with the models that we build that we can't do with the real thing. We can't break people intentionally. There's a long history of very important contributions to our understanding of the mind from people who are broken, whether from organic causes or from violence or whatever it may, from disease, whatever it may be. But we can't do it intentionally. The computers, however, we can break intentionally, and we can break in different ways, and we can try to match the brokennesses that we find in real people. And if we succeed, that gives us some sense that we've actually identified some real explanatory power. We've really uncovered some kind of explanation. Because it's one thing to say, oh, I built this computer program and it adds 2 and 2. And, you know, it gets the same answer that people do. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not impressed. I don't suppose that that necessarily tells me anything at all about how people add small numbers. But when John Seely Brown and Richard Burton, back in the late 70s, built a computer program that made the same kind of mistakes that elementary school students make when they're learning to add, that was much more interesting. Especially because it came from properties of the program which weren't built into it, in the sense that they didn't write the program to say, right, you know, we have this example of somebody adding 13 and 17 and getting 20. So we'll write a computer program that when you give it 13 plus 17, it types out 20. And it's like the program that prints out the right answer. That doesn't get you a good mark in introductory computing, and it doesn't explain anything in cognitive science. But if you have a program which does correctly add 12 and 17, or 13 and 16, or even 13 and 19, but gets 13 and 17 wrong, then maybe there's something interesting going on. This happens to be an example that we're not going to look at again, but I'm talking through it because it illustrates a paradigm that we're going to come back to over and over again, which is that the corner cases, the mistakes, the cases, the behavior under stress, the failures to do the expected thing, often provide more insight into the mechanism and provide more guidance for the person building the model than normal behavior. Because normal behavior is so ordinary. So cognitive science is this notion of a methodology at heart. It's a methodology founded on the idea that the way we explain things is by characterizing a process, a computation, a formal specification, an explicit realization in some computational framework of behavior. And that gives us much more confidence that we found something out than anything we can do with pencil and paper. Well, I've been sort of waving my hands as if we all knew what I was talking about when I talk about the mind. And in fact, that's an enormous challenge, an enormous question. And it's occupied some of the most insightful and thoughtful people among our compatriots, if you will, over the last 2,000 years. I mean, it really does go back well before 2,000 years ago into ancient Greece and ancient Rome and ancient China and other places that we probably don't have records of. What is it that makes us so different from all the other creatures on this planet? There's some qualitative difference. It's not just, the obvious differences that separate us from everybody else, including even our nearest biological relatives, the great apes, the chimps, the gorillas, the orangutans. And remember, I mean, this has all come out fairly recently, but you probably know it already, that by some fairly straightforward measure of gene difference across the chromosomes, it turns out this figure is a little bit misleading because it's 2 or 3% of the 60 or 70 or 80% that we can line up at all. We don't have the same number of chromosomes as all of the things we're comparing with, and there are other odd sort of glitches at the margins of this story, but for a very substantial part of our genome, we are identical to the chimps and the gorillas. And only 2 or 3% of the genes in that huge area where we are broadly comparable are different. And that 2 or 3% makes us really quite close to these fellows. And this is an interesting picture because it illustrates in two different ways the differences, okay? On the one hand, down here, we have the genetic distance, the difference in the mitochondrial DNA. Between us and the chimps, 2%. Between us and one of the earliest hominids, Homo habilis, about 1%. Between us or any one of contemporary humanity and any other member of contemporary humanity, about 0.1%. That's all you need to account for the difference between you and me, or between any two of you, or any of us and anybody else on the planet. But this also lines up because the rate of mutation is pretty constant, has been at least for the last umpty million years, although there are periods further back where it varies. Right, for the last 4 or 5 million years, whoops, I didn't try to do anything there. Get back. Thank you. We can also convert this scale here into approximately millions of years. So the current Homo sapiens diverged into its species, the races that we know today, about 200,000 years ago. The Neanderthals branched, or we branched from the Neanderthals, and the Neanderthals lost about 500,000 years ago. We get back 2, maybe 2.5 million years ago to the hominids, the beginning of the hominids, and only 4 million years since we split off from the chimps, and the gorillas are a little further back. Not that much, maybe another million years to get back to where the gorillas split off from us and the chimps. 5 million years, right? That's, what is it, 200,000 generations? That's really not very much at all. There really isn't much that you can do in that time. You can just get about 2% different in terms of your DNA. And yet there's this astonishing difference in our natures, if you will. And, you know, the sort of going in position, I guess, of what we're going to talk about. Oh yeah, and there's some more numbers here, of course. Because those differences are relatively small when you compare them to the next obvious set of differences. 30 million years for the apes to split off from the rest of the monkeys. And 75 million years for the primates to split off from the rest of the mammals. So the fraction of time that we've been evolving separately compared to the time that we got basically, you know, the basic body type that we're going to be working with here, 5 million as opposed to 75 million. So this astonishing difference is not based on anything very obvious. It is, in particular, it's worth noting, not based on size or number of neurons, although the number of neurons in your head, the estimates for that have varied a lot over the last 20 years. The estimates have been consistently varying across lots of different species, and it's reasonably clear that we don't have a statistically significantly greater number of neurons in our heads than the chimps do. We have fewer neurons than the gorillas do, and substantially fewer than the whales do. Now, there's an open question about whether whales have minds. It's not one we're going to investigate here. But whatever else is the case, they aren't building universities and chairs and laptops and giving lectures. And so we're going to stick with the species that is. But size isn't the issue. And, you know, gross anatomy, gross neural anatomy isn't the issue either, because if you look at chimp brains or gorilla brains, there's a lot of similarity in the gross neural structuring. So, you know, what have we got that they haven't got? Well, one way of getting at this is to look at this business of making sense of the world. That in one way or another, that's what any creature who's going to survive has to do. However the world impinges on you, whatever your mechanisms for coupling with the world to get a sense of what's going on out there and affecting the world, changing yourself, changing the world, however all that's managed, right? It's basically about making sense so that you know what to do next. You have to sort out the safe from the dangerous. You have to sort out food from non-food, mates, potential, from competitors to keep you from getting a mate, and so on. And we seem to do that in a way that's qualitatively different than anything else. What is it that enables this? Language plays a key role because it allows us to change the next generation in ways that are much more effective than physical interaction. We get to evolve culturally and socially and to pass on the results of that evolution via a completely new channel. By communication. And we'll come back to that as we talk through the language strand. But overall, it is tempting to say, gee, we've got this separation, we've got this notion of the mental, which other animals don't. Or do they? How would we know? Just how different are we? Well, I'm going to show you a few videos that are illustrative of a particular line of questioning that's actually only about 40 years old. It's not particularly cognitive science, but it gives us a way of starting to think about this. It seems like one of the things that you might think was pretty importantly different about us from anything else is self-awareness. We know that we are individuals. We know what the difference is between us and everything else. We're aware of ourselves in some way. It's tempting to suppose that, you know, it's sort of it seems obvious, but maybe it isn't, that, oh, I don't know, slugs, crickets, rabbits aren't self-aware. But in fact, there are some ways we can test this. That's not it. There we go. That's enough of that. That's very anecdotal, but I have to say, I find that pretty compelling evidence. You're going to give me my... There we go. Well, that's not what I want quite. I think that's pretty compelling evidence that that dog doesn't recognize him or herself. Right? That's the behavior of a dog confronted with another dog. And it doesn't get it, does it? Right? It doesn't get that when it backs up, the other dog backs up, and when it comes forward, the other dog. It doesn't conclude anything from that. In fact, it's not clear that getting it or concluding things are even appropriate language for describing what's going on there. And as I said, back in about 1970, I think the first experiment was done by somebody trying to get a little more concrete about demonstrating what mirrors could tell us about self-awareness. And over the last 30 years or so, a lot of experimentation has been done with basically the same paradigm that we're about to see one way or another, which is putting some form of mark on the body of an individual in a way which isn't particularly obtrusive in the marking, although that's not true in the particular videos I'm going to show you, but it doesn't seem to matter. And then confronting the individual with a mirror and observing whether or not they engage with the reflection in such a way that suggests that they realize that the mark is on them. A mark which they cannot see except in the mirror. And odorless and colorless, and, you know, well, not colorless, but odorless and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there are various ways in which this has been done to try to make it as clear as possible that it's the visual pathway to something which is not otherwise visible except via the mirror that's revealing to the individual that they are marked. And what we find is that only a handful of species can do this. And in fact, humans can't do it either for quite a while after birth. I'm sorry, the voiceover here is a little bit obtrusive, but it's worth watching for a little bit.
All right, let's just try something, baby.
Not exactly controlled experimental conditions.
What do we have here? Who do we have here? Who is that? I forgot the mirror moves.
Probably enough of that. 17 and a half months, that particular infant. But it kicks in at around 18 months. That's the usual bell curve, sometimes younger, sometimes older, but by 2 or 2.5, virtually all mentally, socially normal human beings behave much more like this one.
I'm gonna hide the video of you because you can't stop staring Shema. At yourself. That is Shema. Okay. Who is that?
Dog.
Those are dogs. There's dogs. There's your friend Misha. Lots of good stuff, you know? Lots of stuff. Very good. This black lipstick is silly. Look.
Shema.
That's your friend Misha. Okay. Naomi, I'm going to have you look in the mirror, okay?
So that was a distraction to try to...
Who is that? What's going on?
Shema.
What's going on here? That's right. You got something on your head.
Completely different, huh? Not surprised, you know, took him a while, but pretty clear a difference there. Right? That wasn't longitudinal, wasn't the same baby. There have been lots of studies where you do use the same babies every month or so, and you see this difference, right? You see something kick in at around the year and a half. Whales, yes. Dolphins, yes. Chimps, And gorillas? Yes. Magpies? That's a bit of a surprise. Not clear what's going on there. Wouldn't have thought a magpie was in the same general category as the other ones that we've got positives for. Because there are lots and lots of negatives. Not dogs, not cats, not any of the monkeys. Yada, yada, yada. Right? Pigs, maybe. But pigs are smart. We all knew that, right? Those of you who've read Roald Dahl know that pigs are smart. But, you know, what is exactly going on here? It's only indicative. It's just an illustration. There are lots of ways in which people have picked holes in this experimental paradigm. But there's something going on here, and it's something that connects up with our own sense of ourselves. And maybe that's important. But does it really test self-awareness? Well, maybe. And we'll come back to this. Again, this is not something we're going to focus on. But when we talk about consciousness at the end of the semester, we'll come back to this whole question. Another way in which we can start getting at what's going on in the mind and its relationship to the body and the brain is the kinds of evidence that have been uncovered over the last 50 or 60 years that this process of making sense of the world, particularly making sense of the most sophisticated of our sensory processing, linguistic and visual processing in particular, recognition both of sounds as language and of shapes as individuals, is hugely difficult. It takes an enormous amount of mental effort. So much that we can't actually do it and do anything else very well at the same time. One of the astonishing underlying facts of the matter is that another thing, just like I said a while ago, that size doesn't matter. In the sense that we understand simple computation, speed doesn't matter either. Because insofar as it makes sense to talk about how fast things are happening up here, if you understand the analogy with computers, which is always tempting and always has to be treated with care, you know, or you've at least seen in the advertisements, you may not really know what this means, and it doesn't really matter what it means in detail, that this laptop, which is itself more powerful than the entire computing provision of the British university system when I arrived here 30 years ago, right? Things have changed a lot. This thing does 2 × 10⁹, 2 American billion operations a second. This thing, well, its fundamental units anyway, the neurons, change state roughly every 100 milliseconds, or 10 times a second, as opposed to 10⁹ times a second. So the processor up here is Stone Age. Well, in fact, as we observed a little while ago, it's much older than Stone Age, right? But there are a whole lot of them, and they're all working in parallel. And the architecture that that enables is qualitatively completely different from what we have in these guys. And, you know, we think, oh my God, we're getting up into the big numbers. We've got parallel computers now which have 128 CPUs, or maybe even 256. And those are pretty smart CPUs. We've got, you know, again, 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 9th, people differ, 10 to the 12th sometimes, you see, neurons. Well, neurons aren't very smart. Neurons aren't very computationally powerful. But something's going on that enables an enormous number of them working together to achieve things which this guy can't even come close to. But one of the ways that it does that is by focusing its power very narrowly much more narrowly indeed sometimes than we realize. And to come back, to combine this with the theme that we mentioned before of things, when they don't work, reveal something about the mechanism. So I'm going to show you an example of how our speech processing system works incredibly hard using all kinds of clues to figure out what it is that people are saying to them, which turns out to be an incredibly challenging and difficult task. Here's an example of how this works. Watch and listen to the video that I'm going to play. And
ba 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 ba.
And again
ba 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 ba.
It's a bit odd. I think this guy is an American and we have strange accents. But now I want you to write down, just write down on a, if you've got a piece of paper, write down what you think he said just then. I mean, it's a nonsense syllables, right? But write down what you think those six nonsense syllables were. And then I'm going to play it for you again. Only this time, when I play it, I want you to close your eyes and just listen. Don't look at the screen. 5, 4, 3, close your eyes. 2, 1.
Ba, 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 ba.
And again, close your eyes.
Ba, 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 ba.
I promise I did not change the video. Write down what you think you heard that time. And finally, I'm going to turn the sound off and play it again. And I want you to, you know, I know you're not lip readers, but you actually are. Everybody's much better lip reader than you think you are. In fact, many of you might have realized that you're pretty good at lip reading if you've ever tried it. Give me a break here. This time, watch him and see if you can tell what he's saying. And again. That'll do. So here's what many people report. Actually, let's get some samples before I tell you what the official story is. I don't know anybody's name, and even when I learn them, I'll forget them again. So I'm going to pick at random. In the fourth or fifth row there, see who I'm pointing? I'm sorry, it's rude to point, but you. Yeah, what did you write down? Yeah, you. Give me letters so that we... All three times. Okay. Person next to you? No, wait a minute. You're not the person next to him. Yep. So that's D. D for dog, A. And second time? T. And third time? Right. And you? Right. Okay. I'm now going to tell you what was actually going on. This was a recording of somebody saying ba, 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 synchronized with a video of the same person saying ga, ga, ga. And the result is that most people, not everybody, but many people hear it as a slightly odd version of da, da, da. Which is not what is either being said or in either the oral or the visual modality. You hear something which isn't there at all, that is a sort of synthesis or a split the difference between a sound that's made out at the front of the mouth with your lips, ba, that's where the sound is coming from, and an articulation at the back of your mouth, which is where the ga is coming from. And what you end up hearing is something that sounds nearest to something that's articulated in the middle, where da is articulated with the tongue at the roof of the mouth. So your mind is trying to make sense of an impossible signal, a combination of something visual and something oral, which never occurs in the real world, and the best it can do. It can't realize that it's being fooled. I mean, the best it can do is combine the two in this rather unusual way. And you can't stop it from happening. Even knowing that it's happening, you can't attend to just the acoustic or just the oral while still keeping your eyes and ears open. And that's a property of some, but not all, of the cognitive processes that we're going to look at over the next months, that knowing what's going on may or may not allow you to fix it, if you will. Let's look at a few more, and then we have to stop for today. One of the ways in which we make the best of the limited computational power we've got up here is to depend on the fact that the world is pretty reliable. You know, by and large, it's very rarely the case that the color of these walls will slowly start to shift while I'm talking to you. So my mind, my brain, my optic system, wherever you want to put it, that this happens, pays almost no attention at all to what's going on out there. And you could get away with a heck of a lot out there, right, by depending on that fact. We ignore things that are not going to change unless they do change. There's a contradiction there, and it's an interesting question what the threshold is. And we'll look in very careful detail at one particular example of this in the coming weeks. But this is an example, and what I'm talking about is the phenomenon of attention. And in the psycho-perceptual cognitive science literature, attention is a technical term. It's the name we give to this thing where we don't pay any mind, we don't use any computational effort, except in a very narrowly focused region. Here's an example of how hard it is to concentrate. This is a video. Some of you may have seen it or something like it before. If you have, please don't give the answer away to the people around you. Because I'm going to show you a video, and you're going to be asked to count the number of times that something happens. And because that something is happening in a number of different places, it's very, very difficult to pay attention to what you need to pay attention to. But that's the part of the reason, that's the illustration. So do your best to follow the instructions in the video that I'm about to show you and to pay attention to what it tells you to pay attention to. Could be called an attention test. Whoa, we're not getting any audio here. Oh, wait a minute. Well, too late. Now I am going to show it to you again with the audio. Guess I'd forgotten to turn the audio back on.
This is an awareness test. How many passes does the team in white make?
Go!
The answer is 13.
Yes. Good.
But did you see the moonwalking bear?
No!
Please do. But that's not the point. So, I take it from the laughter that many of you didn't see the bear the first time around. People prepared to admit that by putting your hand up? Everybody in the room, right? With one or two exceptions. Some of you may have seen the gorilla and known what was coming. The version of this that's most common on YouTube has a gorilla rather than a bear. And this one was one from the GLC much more recently that I thought was actually a little better. But the point is that if you're attending to something else which is hugely obtrusive is completely invisible because it's not what you were paying attention to, even though that guy came across, stopped in the middle of the stage, waved his hands, moonwalked, and walked off again, and most of you didn't see him. Right? So that very fact demands explanation. And that's the kind of thing we're going to look at in the memory and attention strand. We see very little except what we're focused on. Less than you think, in fact. This wasn't another experiment you can do on yourself. We have very, very little color awareness outside the region, a very narrow region, that we're focused on. But we keep a synthetic picture of the rest of the visual field as if it were colored, right? Our mind thinks everything we're seeing is colored, even though our eyes know better. And you can detect this in a very simple way yourself. Next time you're at a traffic signal, I want you to try this, right? As long as it's going to stay red for a little while, right? Keep looking straight ahead. Keep looking at the traffic signal itself that's across the intersection from you. So I'm going to keep looking at you, all right? But now I want you to hold up a book, all right? Somebody over here, hold up a book, all right? And the equivalent of that for the traffic signal is, as you see cars come into your visual field, don't turn over here and see, oh yeah, it's black, right? But keep staring straight ahead and just use your peripheral vision to make a guess as to what color it is. And you'll find that you can't. That in fact, your peripheral vision is black and white. It's not green. You know, I can see green. I know that thing's green. I see it as green, but actually, I'm not seeing it as green. I'm just remembering that it's green. Thank God it's still green, you know? And you can have that same experience if you try this thing at a traffic light, traffic signal. You see, I am American. Last of all, a couple of illusions, which again exploit the fact that we depend on certain properties of the real world. We get cues from those properties, and we use that to synthesize our understanding of what we're seeing or hearing. And if you cheat and produce impossible percepts, you fool us into thinking we're seeing something that isn't there. You've probably seen this one. It's a famous etching by Escher of a staircase and people walking up, or is it down the staircase? In this reproduction, it's a little hard to see, Here's a simpler version where it's easier to see what's going on. Which way are the stairs going? How is it possible to keep going upstairs but come back to where you started? It looks more to me like they're all going down, but if you look at it for a while, you can make them all go the other way. What I didn't know until recently is that there's also an oral equivalent of this. And on this, we're going to have to end. Actually, I'm going to play it over here because I get a little more control out of it. Get there. It's always going down, but it's actually not any lower than it was when it started. And you can tell, if I grab it and go back, it's still right where it was, but it's been going down all the time since it was there. It's incredibly complicated how this is produced. I can't even begin to explain it to you. But it's basically the same deal, right? It's an impossible stimuli. It could not arise in nature. It has to be manufactured. And it fools your ears into thinking that it's a continuously descending tone, when in fact it's not. It's just whatever it is. It's a shepherd tone, is what it's called, technically. You can look it up if you're interested. So that's the end of today's lecture. That's just a sort of taster of... Thank you. Some administrative details, which we'll review next time, and we'll cover all the bits and pieces. You should know where the webpage is. Eventually, the lectures will start appearing on the webpage. I hereby notify you that you have been told that plagiarism is wrong, drugs are bad, and you should always respect your parents. Plagiarism is wrong. Do your own work. You won't learn anything if somebody else does your work for you, or if you do work for somebody else. Please don't make me spend arbitrary amounts of time in incredibly tedious meetings dealing with somebody who has stolen their homework assignment from you. Tutorial groups and assignments and timings will be discussed on Thursday. Notices will come by the mailing list. If there's anybody here planning to take the course who isn't registered via Euclid, get registered so that I can start sending you email. That is all. See you same time, same place on Thursday. Thank you. I just converted it back to here, but if you want it on the laptop, you push.
No, I use this one.
Yep.
So
it's there. You are. It's projected.
It's up, is that? Oh, great.
You'll have to,
log in and stuff. Yeah. Is there a microphone? Yes, yeah.
It seems like this one's on. This is dead. Right. That one's on.
I need this one. So you say
it's dead.
Right. Let's get the services on that case then.
The battery, it looks like the batteries are dead.
Start of the semester.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't find out until it was too late for me to go away.
That's why I got here in good time, because I knew there was problems.
Okay, well, that's more than we're registered, but that's good. Hi, what can I do
Mr.
for you?
McCullough,
sorry?
Are you Mr. McCullough?
No, that's Mark. Oh, right. Still, try after the government. Yeah, that's all right.